Please proceed.
Thank you.
Justices of the Supreme Court, my learned friend from the state, my name is Cameron Krager. On behalf of the defendant, may it please the court. In this case, the district court committed clear error in finding that trial counsel was correct about the applicable law, or it properly advised the defendant on the risk of pleading no contest without the benefit of a plea agreement in his criminal trial, and it committed clear error in denying an evidentiary hearing on the remaining issues, or by not finding that the evidence of ineffective assistance of counsel was clear from the record. For trial counsel failing to request a competency evaluation, failing to advise defendant on the insanity defense, and failing to strike non-victim impact statements from the pre-sentence investigation report. As to the first issue on failing to properly advise the defendant, there's no smoking gun evidence in this case regarding improper communication of the law here. However, there's plenty of circumstantial evidence which points to the fact that trial counsel was either incorrect about the applicable law or did not adequately communicate that law to the defendant, resulting in prejudice.
Could we actually begin with the state's cross-appeal?
Yes.
Because I think that's a hurdle you have to get over before we get to the merits. So what's the argument as to why this is not barred by the one-year statute of limitations in the post-conviction act?
The two arguments I had was the district court had three times ruled on what the mandate would be in this case. There were two rulings, I believe, a month or so after the appellate court had made their ruling on appeal, and then there was another ruling a year later.
Are you talking about spreading the mandate? Are you calling the trial court's action in spreading the Court of Appeals mandate as a ruling of some sort?
I'm not sure what you mean by spreading the mandate. I think you set a date for the mandate, which I think to, you know, an average observer would think you have a year from that date to file your appeal.
Well, that's part of the inquiry. What's day one?
What's day one? Well, you know, I didn't do the math on the appellate court because I don't think it's necessary because the decision was made in the district court and not appealed.
But how do you get past State versus Huggins, which very specifically says, for purposes of this post-conviction statute, the conclusion of a direct appeal occurs when a Nebraska appellate court issues the mandate in the direct appeal. It doesn't say the district court spreading the mandate. It says when the appellate court issues the mandate, which in this case the Court of Appeals issued its mandate.
I think it's explained because the hearing is going to be in the district court. The motion is filed in the district court. And then the district court can set that date based on his math that the district court judge did himself. And then also, when the second judge, Judge Smith, ruled on it, he decided that the filing was timely filed. And then you have two periods of time when the state could have appealed that and then decided not to.
I'm not sure I understand I want to be sure I understand what you're saying when you're talking about the district court setting the date. Mm-hmm. To what are you referring?
The district court had two orders where it set the mandate sometime late July of I want to say, 2016.
So the court entered judgment. We've got the mandate being issued by the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the district court clerk filing it below.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few days later, the district court enters judgment on the mandate.
Yes.
And then a day or two later, an amended judgment on the mandate.
Yes.
All right. So are you calling the judgments on the mandate some sort of action by the court setting a date of some sort?
Yes, it's setting the appeal date for that. That's when the one-year filing tolls.
Is that what they said they were doing?
It says judgment on the mandate, and then it sets a specific date. So I'm not quite sure what the judge's logic would have been otherwise for setting that mandate.
Was the date on which the judgment on the mandate was filed? Just
no,
the filing
it was not.
Date.
It was a different date. He set a different date than the date he filed the mandate.
So if the appellate court issues a mandate on January 1,
mm-hmm.
and on January 3, it's filed in the trial court,
mm-hmm.
and the trial judge doesn't get around to entering an order spreading the mandate, which is the traditional language associated with doing that, until June 15th. Your argument is it doesn't start on January, the 1 year doesn't start on January 1, it starts on June 15. What's your best argument for that proposition?
If the judge set that date to be, the district court judge set that date to be January 1, then I think everyone would understand that to be the mandate, but on June 15th he sets the date to be June 18th.
I'm having the same problem Judge Stacy alluded to. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by sets the date? Sets what date?
Well, you have a one-year appeal from the date of...
You're saying it triggers the clock.
Yes. Triggers the clock for the appeal.
Do you believe
or
that...
For the motion to file post-conviction relief.
So in my example, it's where the mandate was spread on June 15th. Is that day one, or is it... You said June 18th, and I don't know where that came from.
The date that the judge made that order was not the date where he set the mandate. He set a different date that was later than the date he made the order.
I'm still back here on the language of set the mandate. If the statute refers to issue a mandate, mm-hmm. is that not a different event than whatever the trial judge may have done upon receipt of the mandate?
No, I don't believe so, because I believe the plain language is when you're talking about a filing in the district court, the district court said the judge.
But I'm not talking about what events took place at the district court. Mm-hmm. I'm referring to an appellate court issued a mandate. Mm-hmm. What's unclear about that?
Well, from what I've seen in these cases before, when you're disputing the date, it almost always seems that the appellate court issues its mandate, and then, you know, the appellant and the appellee are fighting about what's the correct date up above. I think Judge Funk did the correct thing by saying, well, this is the date, and this is, you know, by me setting this mandate in the date of the mandate in the district court, you have a year from this date to file. Well, that was my understanding of what was occurring in this case.
The language in the post-conviction statute, subpart 4A, deals with the conclusion of a direct appeal, mm-hmm. right? So that might leave open for interpretation, what is the conclusion of a direct appeal? Mm-hmm. But doesn't State versus Huggins decided in 2015 decide that for us? In its very specific language, in fact, several times in that opinion, saying that the conclusion of a direct appeal occurs when the appellate court issues its mandate.
That makes sense, but then I think then Judge Funk did the math and decided, well, here's the date in the district court.
Well, what do you mean do the math?
Well, because there's also plenty of cases discussing, you know, is the case still open? Did you have a chance to appeal to the United States Supreme Court? Did you take further appeal to the State Supreme Court? You know, did you not? Is the case still open? Is there a mandate issued?
But none of that happened here. We just have the Court of Appeals issuing the mandate.
Yes, that's correct.
So how do you get around the language from Huggins that Judge Bishop is quoting?
Well, again, I think that, and I guess I can't read Judge Funk's mind, it seems to me that he was setting the date, by issuing that order, he was setting the date in the district court so that people would know, you know, when the filing would be in the district court.
Is it your position that a district court judge can somehow, in the spreading of the mandate, affect the issuance of the mandate, the date that the mandate is issued, by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court?
Not the issuance of the mandate, but I do believe he can set the date of the filing in his district court. And then again, Judge Smith also decided it was promptly filed, and then the appellant made the appellee made no response to Judge Smith's filing that the motion for post-conviction relief was timely filed.
I'm looking at the judgment on the mandate, and I don't see anything in it at all that mm-hmm. sets a date for mm-hmm. post-conviction. I really want to be sure I understand your argument in that regard.
I think by using language, you know, setting the mandate and then also setting it on a different date from the date he made the judgment, that's, to my understanding, he's setting a filing date.
There's no reference to a filing date or to post-conviction.
No, there's no reference to a filing date.
Order spreading the mandate.
No, there is not.
Thank you.
In the minute I have left, I would just like to point to a couple other cases. There's Silver, which is a 1998 case, and Harris, which is a 2002 case, that I believe contradict the finding that when the denial of one issue on post-conviction relief motion you're required to appeal that issue immediately. Also, look, and that is an incorrect interpretation of Nebraska Revised Statute 25-13-15. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I will begin with the cross appeal, and State v. Huggins is dispositive on the issue of when the clock starts under 4A for the post-conviction statute. This court held that the one-year limitations period begins to run when the appellate court issues the mandate in the direct appeal. In this case, the mandate was issued on June 28, 2016, which means that the defendant had until June 28, 2017 to file his motion for post-conviction relief. He did not file within that time frame, and his motion was untimely filed. He argues in his brief that the state has essentially waived the statute of limitation claim by missing several deadlines in this case. His first argument is that the state had to either object to or file a timely appeal from the district court spreading of the mandate, and this is simply incorrect. First of all, the state could not have appealed from the district court spreading of the mandate as it is not a final appealable order. This court has repeatedly said that the judgment of the appellate court is a final judgment in the cause and that the entry of that judgment in the lower court is a purely ministerial act. Moreover, there is nothing incorrect about the district court's entry of the judgment in this case. In spreading the mandate, the district court's entry correctly stated that the mandate was issued by the appellate court on June 28, 2016, and that is the pertinent date for the timeliness issue. The date of the entry of judgment of the mandate is simply not relevant to the statute of limitation issues in this case.
Even if the order had not recited the date of issuance of the mandate, would that have made a difference?
No, it would not have. Cook also claims that the state should have appealed from the November 2nd, 2017 order, and as this court has consistently held, that order was a final order only to the claims dismissed without an evidentiary hearing. It was not a final order regarding the claim at issue in this appeal, and thus the state could not have appealed that claim at that time. This appeal is the first opportunity for the state to challenge the district court's ruling on the statute of limitations claim relating to the claim that was scheduled for an evidentiary hearing. There is also an argument regarding equitable estoppel, and the state believes it clearly does not apply here. There was no action taken by the state that prompted any type of detrimental reliance. The district court in this case simply spread the mandate in order to obtain jurisdiction in the case after the direct appeal. Regarding the merits of the post-conviction claim, I believe the state's position in that regard is clearly set forth in our brief, and I do not have anything to add on that unless this court would have any specific questions about that or about the statute of limitations. We ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court, but for the reason that it is time-barred, I guess, is what we are asking, not that it is denied without an evidentiary. I don't know how to explain this, but we want the judgment affirmed because the district court did deny post-conviction relief, but yet on the grounds that it was untimely filed. So the evidentiary hearing should not have been granted to begin with. Thank you.
Thank you. We have some time left, is that right?
Yes.
I'll wait for Bob.
All right then, sir. Thank you. Thank you. We're adjourned.